Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Kristen Beck is a veteran of the Elite SEAL Team 6 unit who came out publicly as transgender 2 years after retiring from the Navy in 2011. President Trump tweeted that transgender people will be barred from serving in the military. Beck replied, "Let's meet face to face and you tell me I'm not worthy." Kristen Beck was a SEAL for 20 years and received both a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Later in the hour, we will hear Kristen Beck's story as told to psychologist Ann Speckard. But first, we'll listen to a rebroadcast of a prior interview with Ann Speckard. My guest today is the wife of a U.S. ambassador, a psychologist, and an expert on terrorism. She lectures to security experts worldwide. Ann Speckard is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical School. She has provided expert consultation to European and Middle Eastern governments, NATO, and the U.S. Department of Defense regarding programs for the prevention and rehabilitation of individuals committed to political violence and militant jihad. She is the author of 3 books and many scientific articles about psychological trauma. Ann Speckard has interviewed over 400 terrorists, extremists, their supporters, hostages, and family members in the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, and Europe. Her latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Understanding the Psychosocial Motivations of Militant Jihad Terrorists, Mass Hostage Takers, Suicide Bombers, and Martyrs. Ann Speckard, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm sure people are wondering, how does somebody even become an expert on terrorism? And you start out your book, I mean, when you start out, you get married, you have children, you think, oh, what a typical American life. You did have a PhD. But how did that get you on this road of being an expert on terrorism?
Nancy, actually, I wanted to write my book exactly from that point of view because I grew up in the Midwest and I consider myself a Midwestern girl, just normal like other people. And the fact that I did go out and interview all these terrorists still kind of amazes me. And I just happened to do it step by step. Probably the first step was when my husband followed the track of becoming a U.S. ambassador, he took us overseas. And like you said, I got my PhD, although I got that because I was waiting for him. He was a year behind me in university. And I fell into it. And once I got into it, I became completely fascinated, obsessed in a way, and interviewed as many of them as I could because I wanted to understand what motivates these people.
Well, you know, a fictional character came to mind. When I started reading your biography, I thought, Indiana Jones. And he was an academic and an adventurer. And you've topped him because you're an academic, an adventurer, and a mother and wife.
That's funny.
In fact, you said that when your husband said, well, I'm going to be an ambassador in this foreign country. And you said, but what about the children? That thought, well, now that's a mother speaking right there. And then you're wondering, well, but what'll I do there? And his words were.
He said, you'll find something. I trust you'll be busy within 6 months. And he was right.
So what was your first, where did he go?
We went first to Belarus, and that was very interesting because we went across the Iron Curtain. I'm old enough that I remembered the Iron Curtain. Took our kids, put our youngest one in what's called Detsky Sad, which is children's kindergarten, and he had to learn to speak Russian. We all spoke Russian. Then we went to Belgium. Then we went to Greece. And during that time, my husband also spent 2 years in Iraq.
So you have this opportunity to learn Russian, which later came in handy.
Yes.
And you tell us that you were in Belgium. Mm-hmm. I think you were in Belgium, in Brussels.
Right.
When something terrible happened in Moscow that you were concerned about a friend of yours who lived in Moscow.
Right. The Chechen terrorists had overtaken the Dubrovka Theater, and they held 800 hostages. Probably the listeners remember that. There were 40 terrorists in the theater. 20 of them were women, and they were wearing suicide belts. And they held these 800 people for 3 days. And the first day when I heard of it, I immediately emailed my colleague, who's a PTSD expert as myself, in Moscow and said, are you and your family okay? And she told me, yes, we're okay, and proceeded to tell me how they were dealing with the situation.
And so what did you do then?
Well, I asked her, I had helped after 9/11. Probably the listeners don't realize this, but Al-Qaeda said that their next target was going to be NATO. So I was in Brussels, and they said in October they were going to attack NATO. And our diplomats were pretty intimidated by that. And suddenly everything became a bit like a combat zone, that there were guns and fences. And to go to work, you were entering, you know, something that looked quite different.
And this is Brussels.
Right.
Nice city of Brussels.
Right. Exactly.
And suddenly on alert.
Exactly. Our U.S. embassy and NATO. And everyone was on alert. That's exactly the right words. So I was holding debriefing seminars for our expats and diplomats. And I asked my colleague Nadia in Moscow, what are you going to do for the hostages? And her answer was, this is Russia, Anne, nothing. So I said, would you mind an American suggestion, a naive American suggestion? Is it possible we could do something to help them after they get out of the theater? And she said, come on over. So 6 weeks after it ended, I went. I went with no funding. I stayed in her tiny Soviet apartment with her, and we began meeting with the hostages. And our idea was to help them with what they had been through, that probably some of them would get PTSD and need some help. We were about 6 weeks out from the crisis. And if you remember that, Putin's government had gassed the theater, so a lot of the hostages died from the gas, and they weren't ready with an antidote. They didn't tell the doctors what the antidote to the gas was, so they didn't die necessarily from the terrorists, although it would have never happened if the terrorist hadn't come. But with the first hostage we sat down with, she started telling us about conversations with a woman who had a bomb belt on. And when she left, I turned to Nadia and I said, we have two studies. We have all these indirect interviews.
The one you thought you were going to do.
Exactly.
And then?
Indirect study of terrorists, because for 3 days, the women all had active bomb belts on. So this is an interview of a suicide terrorist in an active state, which no researcher has ever done. And we got secondary interviews through the hostages. And a lot of the hostages were well-educated. They were medical people. So they could tell us a lot of observations of how the terrorists were acting, the things that they said. And then on top of that, after 3 or 4 days that I was there, a Chechen academic came to town, and we'd been told a lot of things that Chechens are all crazy, they're all violent, they're terrible people, that's why they did this. And here this lovely woman came to town, and she wanted to meet Nadia. She was studying PTSD and psychology, and I immediately recruited her into our study and said, could you do in-depth interviews with the families back home in Chechnya, the ones that came to the theater, and ask what put them on this trajectory. And that actually is what put me on the trajectory. I started studying terrorists of who were they were, because nobody's born as a terrorist. Who were they were as children? Who were they were as adolescents? What happened to them? How did they become terrorists? And is there a way we can take them off the terrorist trajectory, that we can restore them to normal human beings?
So you think you're going to go study PTSD, which is, compared to this other study, is relatively easy. I mean, you can find subjects just about anywhere. You can walk out your door here in the United States somewhere and find someone just about with PTSD. But if you're going to study terrorist, then you have to give this a lot of thought.
Exactly. So I fell into it. And then the next thing that happened, we were tooling along, and we ultimately did 65 interviews, about 65 suicide terrorists. So we created what we called psychological autopsies. So the terrorist is already dead. He's suicided. And we went back over his life course with a family member or a close associate and tried to figure out what made him and what motivated him. And during that time, I was teaching courses in Belgium, psychology courses in university, and this Irish student started admitting in class that he had PTSD. And I said, Ken, why do you have PTSD? Why do you think you have PTSD? And he said, I was studying abroad at Hebrew University. I had my lunch in the cafeteria. I was speaking with an Israeli soldier and arguing. The point of view of a lot of Europeans is pro-Palestinian. I was arguing with him. I walked out of the cafeteria and it blew up. Everybody inside was killed. And he said, I want to understand the Palestinians. Why don't you study them? Well, he wore me down over a year. And finally, I went to Israel. I thought I would get interviews inside the prison. I did ultimately get interviews inside the prison with people that had bomb belts on but got caught, so they didn't explode themselves. But my first steps were, I ended up going over to the West Bank, to Ramallah. And here I am, such a naive American. I didn't know hardly anything about the conflict over there. And I traveled all through the West Bank, and I traveled in Gaza. And I sat down with families of so-called martyrs, and I even stayed in their homes. You couldn't cross the checkpoint. So they would say, if you want to continue doing your interviews today, you'll have to stay in our home if you want to stay. Otherwise, you need to go back to Ramallah. And I took them up on it. And it was a little scary, but it was amazing.
My guest is Anne Speckhard, and her book is Talking to Terrorists. And since this is a psychosociological study that you're presenting, it could be dry. But I want to give readers a flavor of what your book is like. So, Anne, would you read the introduction to your book? This, again, is Talking to Terrorists, and Dr. Speckhard writes what happened one day. She jumps right into the action when somebody knocks on her door.
Okay. Well, I tried to write this more of as a travel diary with all the theory in it about terrorism, but you'll see the flavor exactly in this. Excuse me, Mr. Ambassador, but do you know where your wife is? It was 7 a.m., and my husband of 24 years, Daniel Speckhard, a diplomat posted to NATO's international staff in Belgium, was standing at the door of our home in Brussels, barely awake. One of the plainclothes agents handed him an FBI calling card. Daniel rubbed his eyes and asked, Excuse me? What? We're sorry, Ambassador Speckhard, to disturb you like this, but your wife has been running around in Gaza meeting with terrorists. Is she pulling a Patty Hearst or something? My husband, now wide awake, said, No, wait a minute. He invited them to come in and take a seat while he ran up to my office and returned with papers in hand. My wife is a university professor, a psychologist. She's an expert on terrorism. She studies this type of thing, does interviews. Here's her latest paper. And her business card, he said, handing them a thick document. She's a professor? Yes, Daniel said. Well, sir, we received a very angry phone call from the Israelis last night accusing us of running an undisclosed CIA agent in Gaza. They thought your wife was undercover. At this, Daniel laughed. She's got nothing to do with the CIA, at least not that I know of. Okay, sorry for disturbing you. But could you please ask her to come in and talk to us when she gets back? It might be a good idea to discuss security issues with her, how to stay safe. He nodded. Yes, he thought, that would be a good idea.
This is Anne Speckhard reading from her book, Talking to Terrorists. And you know what? You mentioned that you being naive, but I thought it was a great scene, too, when you sit down to talk to this former KGB agent. They don't call it the KGB anymore. But I could just imagine the way he talked. And, no, Anne, you cannot get your email from here, wherever it was you wanted to.
To Chechnya.
And he's sitting there smoking and probably sipping vodka. And I could just see this scene with you saying what you wanted to do, and he was telling you, no way.
You're right. I really tried hard to capture the scenes, and I have to say I had a good editor, so she helped a lot, and really tried to take the reader with me, because my goal was for you to see it, for you to be sitting down with a terrorist and feel, what is it like to sit down in Hebron? What is it like to sit down in Nablus? When we go to Casablanca, what does the street look like that the Casablanca bombers came from? What's it like in Camp Buka, inside the prison? What do the Al-Qaeda types say? What do they look like? How do they act?
Well, another character besides that character that I could just see, the character of the professor that, I mean, what luck that you encountered this woman who spoke three languages or maybe more, but it was so helpful. And she was a terrific find. And tell us about her.
Well, her name's Hapta Akhmedova, and she was the first one that I told you. She came right after we had met the KGB or former KGB agent. He didn't tell us he was KGB. It was obvious.
Oh, yeah.
And he had told us that all Chechens are terrible. If you tried to study them, you would end up with your hands or your fingers cut off or you're beheaded. And the very next day, Hapta came in to speak with Nadia, my professor friend. And Hapta was doe-eyed, petite, lovely, spoke three languages. I was struggling to speak to her in Russian. And halfway through hearing all about Chechnya, she said to me in pretty good English, "Would you like me to switch to English?" And she and I collaborated over the years. We collected the psychological autopsies in Chechnya. And when I went into Iraq to work, I...
And getting back to the email, because he said, "No, you cannot get email through to Chechnya." And she was, when you ask her that, she said, "Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do have access to email."
Yeah, he said, "There's no email, it's just rubble. And there's no university functioning." And she was actually teaching in a university, had email. That's how we did all of our communication, except when I brought her into Belgium.
And you know what? In fact, I got the impression that you're a person who, if somebody tells you, "No, that's not possible," whatever reason, and they give you a long list of reasons something's not possible, and you don't believe them, you go ahead and do the impossible.
Oh, you got my personality perfectly. If somebody tells me it can't be done, I tend to want to prove them wrong.
With a smile on your face, I'm sure, but yes. You go ahead and do that.
Yes.
So this woman and you are exchanging email. Now, that's pretty scary because I lived here in South America, and before we even got there, we sent letters to the woman who was going to be meeting at the airport, and our mail had been opened, and this is back before email. So I would be rather apprehensive, as you were, that they were going to be reading your emails and knocking on your door.
I wasn't worried about getting a knock on my door. I was worried that she would disappear. Because there's actually Anna Politskovaya, a journalist that covered the same issues. She was murdered. And I was worried that Hapta could be murdered. And thank God she's still safe and still functioning. But when I went into Iraq, I ended up bringing Hapta along on the program. And she was an amazing psychologist. And I was very lucky to work with her.
Well, there was an interview that she did with a woman who, I mean, these are young women. I mean, you would think you kind of, your typical, stereotypical suicide bomber, for example, is a man. But these are women that would strap bombs to themselves. And she also talked to this woman who grabbed an automatic weapon from a soldier, went through a checkpoint, and took away their automatic weapon and pointed it. And then explained, how could she possibly do something like that?
She temporarily lost her mind. And I think she's such a great example. I think that's Layla that took the automatic rifle. In Chechnya, at that time, if you went across the city, there would be 17 checkpoints you had to cross. And this is where I think it's so good to get into the mindset of the people that do these things. Because she was an ordinary woman, peace-loving. She was a Muslim, but not... following any kind of hateful ideology. And her brother had been killed by the Russian soldiers. So she was in shock and grief, and she definitely wanted revenge against the soldiers. But she had been pulled off a bus at a checkpoint, and the guys were sitting around, the soldiers, with beers, and their automatics were on the ground. And she suddenly, almost in an automatic state, picked up the rifle and held all the soldiers under gunpoint. And to me, it's an example how somebody switches suddenly to an aggressor, from victim to aggressor. And she'd seen too much. And thank God she didn't kill them, because she would have been killed herself later. And she came back into her mind and was completely amazed that she had done this. But that's the kind of thing that happens when people live under violence, when they're constantly under threat, and when they have a brewing anger inside of themselves over things that are really wrong. Her brother had been wrongly killed.
My guest is Anne Speckard, and her book is Talking to Terrorists. She interviewed over 400 terrorists and suicide bombers and their family and friends in the course of writing this book, and it took you 10 years.
10 years of research. It took me a year and a half to write the book.
Because I might mention to listeners that it's 928 pages that you wrote. So that's quite an undertaking. I'm not surprised that it took you 10 years to do that. What about the photograph on the cover of this adorable child with a gun pointed right at the reader?
Some people have asked me, is that a picture of myself? Because I have dark hair. And she's a dark hair, curly-haired Palestinian girl. She's from a safe house in Nablus, and one of the trips into Israel and Palestine, we got off the plane in Tel Aviv, and the news was that two suicide bombers had exploded themselves in Tel Aviv the day before. And we were on our way to Nablus, and they were from Nablus. By the time we got to Nablus, we were making interviews in a small village outside of Nablus called Bet Farik. We were introduced to the families of the bombers. And when we went to see their homes, in that part of the world, people live, grandmother, children, and grandchildren all in the same home. They have different levels. So the first level might be the grandparents, the second level be one of the sons, the third level a different son. But when someone goes as a suicide bomber at that time, the Israelis would come and explode the house. So the houses had already been exploded. And we visited both homes, and we saw innocent people that were suffering because their family member had gone as a suicide bomber. They'd lost their home, and including little children. Then we went into Nablus, and that was extremely scary. It was scary how we got in, scary how we got out. You can read the chapters on that. Terrifying. And I was invited to go to the safe house where these bombers had been sent from. And I decided to do it, and we were interviewing the woman that had launched them. And her little child, this little girl, came into the room with a gun and came up to her mother and whispered to her mother. She thought we were Israelis come to interrogate her mother. And I think she's 4 years old. She's adorable, I think.
Oh, she is.
But she held up her gun because she understood at 4 years old, go get a weapon, the Israelis are here. And I took a picture of her, and the picture on the cover is the second picture I took of her, because as soon as I photographed her, someone else that was in the room with us showed her how to correctly hold the gun. And you can see she's holding it in a military stance.
Well, in fact, that was what my husband commented on immediately. He said, boy, that little girl looks like she knows what she's doing, the way she was holding that gun.
Yeah, at 4 years old, she knows how to hold a gun correctly. And to me, that's one of the central themes in the book. People don't start out this way. They're taught. They're taught to hate. They have lots of experiences that are, especially in conflict zones, in Palestine and Chechnya and Kashmir, in Afghanistan, in parts of Pakistan, Mali probably now. There's people growing up with violence, and they are living in really traumatic circumstances, and it changes them. And then if you come to them with a militant jihadi ideology and a group that's willing to equip them, some of them are troubled enough that they'll join and they'll go and bomb themselves.
You mentioned that you were frightened. I was wondering if you ever did, because I'll tell you how easily scared I am. When we lived in South America, well, we were tear gassed once, but not we personally, but we walked into that. But just to see soldiers standing with semi-automatic weapons, just it's one thing to see it in the movie, but when you see a real one there, that's another thing altogether. And I wondered how you steeled yourself against that. Was your curiosity strong enough that you were willing to face situations like that?
My curiosity was strong enough. I also trusted, especially when I was dealing with Israeli soldiers, that my American passport protected me. But it was really interesting because I dressed like a Palestinian so that I would be dressed conservatively and not offend them at all when I made the interviews. So when I was traveling through Palestine, I traveled just in normal transport. They travel in minibuses in groups. And so these are our little buses, vans. And we'd be stopped a lot. And the soldiers would come with their guns and point them right in our faces. And they generally mistook me for a Palestinian woman. So I got to understand what it's like to be a Palestinian. And I have to say, I didn't like it at all. And at one checkpoint, I was carrying a small bag that had my clothes for overnight and, you know, change of underwear, that kind of thing, my cosmetics. And I came up to the checkpoint, and the woman screamed at me in Hebrew. She was screaming, stop. I don't speak Hebrew. And I had no idea what she was screaming. And she looked like she wanted me to hurry up. So I hurried and came closer to her, which made her scream louder. At first, she didn't really scream, but she said something. And then she screamed, and her next thing was to point her gun at me. And then I understood that she was saying, stop. I went crazy at her, and I said, you need to learn more than one language. And then she understood that I wasn't Palestinian because I wasn't speaking Arabic. But I said, you need to be saying stop in Arabic, and you need to be saying stop in English.
Well, you know, I'm surprised you would get on the bus after Ken, the student of yours, the Irish student, after he told you what he, when he rode a bus, what he would do, and it horrified the other students. He said that if a terrorist came on board the bus, that he had, or anytime he got on a bus, he would pick out the person that he was going to throw at the terrorist. I mean, he wouldn't throw himself to save everybody on the bus. He would. He already picked out somebody that he would throw to.
Okay, I should explain one. Ken talked me into going into the West Bank and Gaza. He went with me. And another student, Val. So I had these two young male students with me all the time. And Ken's hilarious, and he appears all through the book. But it's not really that funny. It's very sad. He had PTSD from the Hebrew U bombing. And one of the things as a compensation was when he continued to ride buses through Israel, he was always afraid that the bus might blow up. So he was ready. And that's exactly what his compensation was, that if he understood that someone was coming on and started screaming Allahu Akbar and was about to blow himself up, that he had already picked the person he was going to throw on the bomber, and the rest of them hopefully live. And we thought that was terrible. We were like, why wouldn't you save the people yourself? And he said, I didn't want to die. And so when we did ride a bus in Israel with him, both Val and I turned to each other and then turned to Ken and said, which one is it? Yeah, which one is it? Which one are you going to throw on the bomber if he comes? And I have to say, it was, I'm sure all Israelis at that time in the Second Intifada were thinking whenever they got on a bus, is this the last bus I'll get on? And you had the same feeling when you went to restaurants or to discos. I mean, they really suffered under the suicide bombing campaign.
Well, and women suicide bombers seem like their stories must have been fascinating because they were young women. What could convince a young woman to strap a bomb to herself?
Well, there's a really interesting story about midway through the book, and it's about Erin Ahmed. And Erin went to prison. She was caught after she had gone on a suicide mission, and her story is very interesting. She was dating a guy. She was going to college, and she was studying business and wanted to be a banker. And she wanted to move out of Palestine. She lived in Bethlehem. She wanted to move out and be a banker and live a pretty modern life. And the guy she was dating agreed to that. So she was excited about her future life, but he was a militant. And she believes he died from a missile being fired to the car that he was in, which was a way that the Israelis were killing many people, just like we do with our drone attacks. If they think they've got one, they send the missile. The Israelis say, no, he was working with a bomb in the car and blew himself up. I don't know. But she believes he got the missile. Within 2 weeks, she changed totally from being a modern woman. She put on very conservative clothes, wrapped a scarf around herself, and went to Hamas and said, give me a bomb. I want to go and kill as many Israelis as I can. And they did. So here's a group that's cold-hearted and willing to take advantage of a woman 2 weeks after her life partner has been killed. And when we interviewed her in prison, she said they should have never done that. I mean, that's really taking advantage of her. And she had the bomb strapped on. She went with another bomber. The young man that she went with did explode himself, but she saw a young child. She was in Israel proper. She saw a baby, and she said, Allah does not give me the right to take life. And she called her sender and said, take me back. But then she was arrested.
Well, there is a hopeful thing, and you've said this, but I would like for you to repeat that terrorists are not born.
That's right. They're not born. They're formed, and we can fight against the things that form them.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and your book is a fascinating read. It is Talking to Terrorists, Understanding the Psychosocial Motivations of Militant Jihadi Terrorists, Mass Hostage Takers, Suicide Bombers, and Martyr. Thank you, Anne Speckhart.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of an interview with terrorist expert Anne Speckhart. At a conference in Washington, D.C., Anne Speckhart met transgender former Navy SEAL Kristen Beck, who asked her to write his story. We will hear a rebroadcast of that 2013 interview after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio.
My guest today has relatives in Gridley, California, and a son at Stanford University. Anne Speckard lives in Washington, D.C., where she is adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical School. She is an internationally recognized expert on terrorism and post-traumatic stress disorder. She has a Ph.D. in psychology and had done clinical work in the field of PTSD for 15 years when her husband joined the State Department and became U.S. ambassador to Belarus and later to Greece. Dr. Speckard has been a consultant to European and Middle Eastern governments, as well as the U.S. Department of Defense, NATO, and other organizations. She is author of Talking to Terrorists and Fetal Abduction. She has already been interviewed on national TV about her newest book, Warrior Princess, a U.S. Navy SEAL's journey to coming out transgender. The book's co-author, Kristen Beck, formerly Chris Beck, was a decorated Navy SEAL and American patriot who faced a lifelong struggle to come to terms with her gender identity. Anne Speckard, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's nice to be back.
How did you meet your co-author?
Well, it was in January this year, and I'm a counterterrorism expert, and I went to a counterterrorism conference, and Chris Beck, as a man and as a retired Navy SEAL, was speaking on irregular warfare. And I was sitting in the audience and was impressed by the talk, but I just had a feeling that I should go and ask Chris for an interview. And the reason I wanted an interview was because I was working with the Navy SEALs, and we were putting together a study looking at psychosocial resilience, so how the SEALs deal with their very intense lifestyle and their so many months away from home and dealing with traumatic bereavement and all the things that they deal with. And I was preparing for that study, and I thought I'd ask Chris for an interview. I had no idea what I was getting into.
So you just go up to this hero, because he was decorated. He'd won all sorts of awards. He's very creative and inventive, and he was very valuable to the state, to the Department of Defense. So you go up to him thinking you're going to get one story, and it turns out to be a totally different story.
Right. I just went and asked him, and I had a very strong intuition that I should do it, and I've learned to trust my intuition. Mm-hmm. So I went to ask him, and I said, I'm putting this study together, and I wonder if you'd give me a background interview. It would help me a lot. Since you're retired, you can speak freely. And he said yes, and we hit it off, and we just sat and talked for a while. There was wine being served and snacks. It was the end of the conference. And suddenly, Chris said to me, I have a gender identity disorder, and took out his phone and went through the pictures and showed me pictures of himself as a woman. And I looked at the pictures and looked at Chris, and I thought he was joking. And I said, come on, you're kidding. And then I realized he wasn't joking. We talked some more, and Chris said, do you write? And I said, yeah, I've written a couple of books. And he said, well, I'd like to write my story. Would you be willing to work with me on it?
If he only knew one of your books was 882 pages long, he would realize, yes, this woman's a writer.
Right, right. So, but my initial answer was, I'm not sure that that would be good for you, because I guess I was just thinking, here's this Navy SEAL, okay, retired, but, you know, in a DOD setting, I thought, don't you have to keep this under wraps? And maybe that shows my age. But I said, I don't know. I don't know if that would be good for you. And let's just have our interview and see where it goes from there. So I met Chris. He was very anxious to meet again. And we met in a couple of days at a restaurant. And when I walked in, I was looking for Chris. And I suddenly saw a woman that looked like Chris. But it was Kristen, and the same person, same skill set, same everything, except a woman. And she was wearing a wig and a very tasteful, elegant dress, and sitting there and invited me to sit down. And I didn't really do a double take, because I'm used to being surprised at things from my work as a clinician. And I'm used to keeping my cool and keeping my emotions inside and just listening. So I sat that night listening for about 5 hours, and I heard an awful lot of pain, awful lot of confusion. And I guess the thing that really got to me is that this was a person that had served our country for 20 years faithfully, and that she shared a lot of the same values as me, And she was just searching for her way and searching for how can I tell this story and how can I make people understand that this is me and I don't know what to do about this except claim who I am. And so I agreed to help her write her story.
Did she say why she wanted to write this book?
Yeah, she said that she really wanted people to understand who she was and what it was about, and she also wanted to speak for other transgenders. She felt that having earned her way as a U.S. Navy SEAL, that she could be a spokesman and that she could present it in a way, if it was written well, that all transgenders would be presented fairly and in a nice way. And I agreed with that. I said there, if we were going to write a book, we had to honor the SEALs, we had to honor her family, and we had to be respectful of everybody. And then we ended up speaking again and a couple nights later, and the amazing thing is she suddenly came out at work, and everything got accelerated, and I was just happened to be there at that time, so I observed it all. I went to Tampa with her. She had come out in the SEAL community. She had come out at DOD. She announced it on her LinkedIn page in a very interesting way, actually. She put up a picture of herself on LinkedIn that was a picture of a big, burly man with a beard, herself, of course, and said, "This is a disguise I wore in Afghanistan." She looked like a Pashtun. And she said, "Pretty soon, I'm getting rid of all disguises." Well, the next day, she put up a professional photo that she had taken when I was there of herself as a woman in a dress standing in front of a flag. And I watched in real time as the SEALs reacted, and you know, a lot of them had my reaction of, "You're joking." And then when they realized it wasn't a joke, I was very amazed and very happy, and Kristen, of course, was happy to see that they were very respectful and kind things. They said things like, you're still my brother no matter what. I know who you are. The skills don't change. The person doesn't change. You do whatever you need to do to heal yourself. Just very kind and loving things. And for me, I saw that the SEALs have, they train and really trust each other and really know the person next to me has my back. And they knew who Kristen really was and who Chris Beck really was. So it didn't matter about gender.
My guest is Anne Speckhard, and her newest book is Warrior Princess, a U.S. Navy SEAL's journey to coming out transgender. And you said that he had planned to come out slowly to take his time, but and you said that got speeded up. And it was actually, you were saying how understanding his brothers were in the military, but when he went home to his family, that was a different story. And at first, I was a little bit horrified that his sister, when you say they have a family fight, I mean, she literally hit him. She punched him. And I think that really, she was in a way doing him a favor, because as I understand it reading the book, that's when he said, "I'm not going to delay this. I'm going to go ahead now."
Right. It was very interesting to me to watch, because I met Kristen that night in the restaurant, and then we arranged to meet again very shortly afterwards, I think a day or 2 days later. But I ended up meeting her after her work, and she was dressed again as a woman, but she was with her work colleagues. And she told me, "I came out at work today." And I spent another 5 hours with her that night, and she told me what had happened. She had gone home, and she had been very, very
home,
proud
meaning
of,
to her the family he grew up with.
Yes, yes. And she was proud of herself, and she, at home, in her own home and in her family's home, she had already begun dressing as a woman for about 2 years. And her family was used to it, but they saw it, at least her mother saw it as some kind of reaction to Afghanistan. Like, you saw too much over there, now you just want to be a woman. And she didn't really understand that this really was Kristen's journey, that she was coming out as a female. And she thought it would just pass, that it was a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. But the mother wasn't in the room, the sister was, and Kristen was telling the sister and others there of how proud she was and how she had given a talk, and she had been on the podium with some very important people. And the sister kind of made fun of her and said, "Well, if they saw you in a dress, what would they think? You know, you're a retired SEAL, but if they saw you dressed as a woman, I don't think they would invite you to come and speak. And they were fighting, and Kristen tried to back out of it and went to lay on the couch. And it's a bit humorous because she was reading the Dalai Lama. But the sister followed her and, and whacked her in the face, punched her in the face. And they got in a big fight, and Kristen's mother came out, and maybe because Chris is trained as a SEAL, took the side of the sister and asked Chris to leave. And Kristen slept in her car that night, but she just got to a point where she said, I've had it. I'm not going to live disguised anymore. I'm going to tell people who I really am. So the next day she went to work as a woman.
And her family, as you just described, was not understanding. And it is hard to know when to say he and when to say she.
That's true.
But at the time when he was growing up, he was growing up. One comment you have in the book, he said, I was beaten on one side of the head with a Bible and the other side of the head with a football cleat because his dad was a football coach.
That's right. The father, I think it was the New York Jets. He had made it into a professional football team, but he had an injury, so he didn't play. So he ended up being a coach instead. And he coached his sons, and Chris had an older brother, and the older brother was a natural athlete. And Chris was more of a scrappy athlete and determined. So the older brother was the quarterback, and Chris became the tackle, but became the tackle that was known for the most quarterback sacks. So he was a tough, hard-fighting athlete, but not the glory one. His brother always had the glory. And their father was tough on them, probably pretty normal for the times, but Chris got the belt. And no one can say exactly why these things happened, but I think in some ways, for Chris, it was pretty tough being a boy when he was growing up, and he identified as a female.
Well, and he said at one point in the book that he knew at a very early age that he was transgender, and that, in fact, that most children know by the time they're 4 years old, they know.
That's true. What we know from child development research is that kids figure out about gender around 3 or 4 years old. They figure out that there's male and female, and then they begin to identify themselves with one or the other. And it was interesting writing this book while I have a four-year-old in the house. I have a granddaughter in the house, and watching her. And she comes and tells me things like, pink is for girls, and girls like pink, and so then I have to like pink. And but she also says she wants to be a Ninja Turtle, but all the turtles are boys. And she wants to be a princess. And it's very interesting seeing the things they pick up from the TV, from the family, from everything they're watching, and figure out, who am I? And so it's usually pretty set by the age of five. And what that means is that for a person living it, if their narrative memory starts at age five, for them it feels like they were born a female in a male body. In fact, it was socially constructed in their family primarily.
My guest is Ann Speckard, and her newest book is Warrior Princess, a U.S. Navy SEAL's journey to coming out transgender, and has been described as one of the most important books of the year. You, when you're talking to this person who knew very young that he was transgender, and yet he decides to be a Navy SEAL. Now, a lot of young men want to be a Navy SEAL. You can't just walk up and sign up and be a Navy SEAL. It's an extremely rigorous selection process. Why did he even decide to do that, Anne?
Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people have asked me, why did he pick such a masculine role? And I've thought about that, and I think from what I know of the SEALs, I don't see it as so masculine, and I don't mean to demasculinate it in any way. It's an amazing heroic choice, but I think it's a mind game. It's mental determinedness, it's fortitude, bravery, courage, and just really staying in the game when others drop out, and, you know, willing to push your body to its absolute limits. And Chris was raised by a football coach in a sports family, in a very patriotic family that valued service to country. So I'm not sure if she had been female and if there was an opportunity to be a female SEAL, if she wouldn't have chosen to prove herself in that way anyway, because the SEALs for her was about proving herself. And then it ended up also offering a way to hide, to because at her age, she's 46, there was no acceptance of transgender. There wasn't even good understanding of it. It wasn't like she could get on the internet and Google it and try to figure out what was going on with her. The internet was being invented as she was being raised.
You know, there were sentences in your book that when you were quoting Chris that were just so heartbreaking. One of those sentences was after he finally had made this decision to become she. And you quote him, "This is the first time in my life that I'm truly happy." Here's a 46-year-old man saying this is the first time in his life he's been truly happy.
That's right. And I think we have to say it wasn't a decision to become she. It was a decision to own that she felt that she was she her whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't feel that this is something she decided. And, you know, it's more that she's just always experienced herself as female and to finally admit that.
But then she also said things like, "I hate myself for not being pretty."
Right, right. Because the body and the mind don't match. And that's just so terribly painful. So she's now worked very hard on, she's lasered off her beard, she's taking hormones, and she's working very hard on making her sense of self and her body match. And it's a terrible thing to try to figure out what should you do if you have this disorder. And I shouldn't even call it a disorder. If you have if you're gender identified in a way different than your body, it's very difficult. And some people come to terms with it and say, that's fine. My gender and my body don't have to match. But if you really want it to match, there's terrible choices. You could probably go to therapy for years and years and years, maybe change what was laid down in early childhood, unlikely, or you can go through a bodily change, which isn't easy either.
You know, a lot of people may be wondering if Chris ever married.
She married twice. She was married as a young man. She succumbed to the pressure to date and dated a very nice young woman, and they had sex, and the woman got pregnant very soon in the relationship. They didn't know each other well. And Chris said he had been raised in a Baptist Lutheran family. And he just never thought of anything else but to say, we'll get married. And he offered her marriage, and she was afraid because they didn't know each other well. And she got into a relationship with a lot of surprises. And Chris never explained to her, "I'm transgender," because I don't think that those were even words that she would have had. It was more instead, late at night, she would dress as a woman, and Chris's wife would say, "What are you doing?" And she'd say, "Well, I just feel more comfortable like this." And then when they had two little boys, the wife would say, "Don't ever do that in front of our kids." And, you know, imagine when there's not good explanations out there or there's just condemnation. It's pretty painful for both of them.
In fact, at one point he says, you quote him as saying, "I was lonely all my life." And that is so sad, because not his family of origin, not the family with his wife and his two sons, none of that. He was still lonely.
Right. So I'm happy that we wrote this book. It's getting a lot of press, and I've gotten so many letters from people, especially people that have served in the military that are transgenders, and also people that are gay, which is a totally different thing, but saying, "Thank you for telling this incredible story. Thank you, because I, too, have been through this." And so I'm happy if we're, you know, shining a light somewhere. I can't say we gave all perfect answers, because there aren't easy answers in these situations. But at least we can start to talk about it, and hopefully talk about it compassionately.
My guest is Dr. Anne Speckard. Her newest book is Warrior Princess, A U.S. Navy SEAL's Journey to Coming Out Transgender. And I thought it was funny. I just imagine this scene because people, wondering, he decides he's going to put on women's clothes. And then what's he going to do? What's the Pentagon going to think? And then he tells his boss at the Pentagon, General Glenn. And what happened when he told his boss at the Pentagon?
General Glenn responded by saying, well, you're not doing drugs and you haven't killed anybody, have you? And, what's the big deal? And actually, I saw that at the Veterans Administration. I went with Kristen, and she was dressed as a woman, and she got a couple of double takes here and there because she's a tall woman. And but she's got a wiry body that can be very attractive for a woman. Like, she's got great legs. And she went and said, I want to change my ID card to female. They hardly batted an eyelash. So I think they're used to it. I think this happens a lot more nowadays than we realize.
Well, I did think it was funny that when Chris is getting up his nerve to tell his boss, and finally tells him he's got this problem, this secret, and when he tells him, the general says, is that all?
Right.
You're not on drugs and you haven't killed anybody?
Right.
So he can handle that. But one thing that when you're talking to Chris about this book going to be published, all this is going to come out in the news, and his mentor, Bill Shepard, who is a very understanding person, but he says, okay, what you need to do is get out a press release because the news trucks are going to be parked in front of your house. And the fact that you had been a diplomat's wife helped you because you had carried high-level clearances.
That's right. Well, actually, as a researcher, but yes, I had clearances, and my husband had clearances, so I knew what that was about. And that was one of the things that Bill talked to Chris about, was that people are going to now question because you were keeping a secret. But I immediately said, well, Chris served under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so you basically received instructions from the military of don't tell. So it wasn't like you were actively lying. You were following the official policy of the time. And Bill said, well, you need to go into SOCOM, and they might want to go back over your clearances and your polygraphs when you were asked certain questions. And Chris said, well, I could have never been blackmailed for this because, if it had to come out, it would have come out. But, she's a real patriot. She, service to country is number one.
Mm-hmm. And she had a counselor at the VA office and at the treatment center. And in one place you quote Chris as saying, my PTSD is gone. I have no more depression.
Right. Well, when she came out, she was very, very happy and feeling very free. And that is a common thing with transgenders that are transsexual, meaning that they just cannot stand to live in the body that they're in, that they want to change their body to match the gender identity that they have. And when she came out and now could wear female clothes, she immediately put hair extensions in, and she's got beautiful hair, so probably by now it's grown out. And she could wear her nails long, she could wear high heels, and she was just euphoric. And I did chuckle when she said, my PTSD is cured, because I thought, I'm sorry.
He's telling an expert this now.
Yeah, that would be quite a cure. And, I'm sure you're very, very happy. And I think the depression truly had lifted. Mm-hmm. But, all the traumas that she's been through, she did 13 deployments, 7 of them in combat, and quite a few of her SEAL team buddies have been killed. So the PTSD is probably still there, but it was certainly helped a great deal by her finally being able to live authentically.
Because he says, as she, I'm tired of hiding and lying to myself.
Right.
But now, with all those deployments that you just mentioned, how can he keep up a relationship with his sons?
Well, that's the hard thing with SEALs in general. They can go out for 8 months in a year, even 10 months in a year, because they go out for their fighting deployments, and then they also have training, and training can be in a different country. So you really can see a SEAL that's only home for a month or 2 months in a year. And so that means all the burden is on the spouse to keep the relationships and keep everything going. And so Chris is no different than the other SEALs in that regard. And then their marriage did fall apart, and his wife moved to a completely different state. So it was very hard to keep her parenting relationship. but she loves her sons very much.
Well, now, at the point where you're writing the book, he has decided to put on, I mean, all this is happening right there when you just meet him. He decides, okay, I'm going to start dressing the way I feel. And the VA was telling him, you're going to have to wait, you're going to have to dress as a woman, as I recall, dress as a woman for a year before you start getting hormones. And he says, if I can't start hormones soon, I'll put a bullet through my head.
That's how painful it was. And that's how transsexuals feel when they really can't stand living in the body that doesn't match their identity anymore. And really the solution for them is they have to change their bodies. Or else they have to come to some kind of peace with the mismatch. And generally the treatment nowadays is to treat the body. And if it's an adolescent, it's kind of interesting now, Nancy, if an adolescent is going through this, they'll offer to you to block your puberty so that you have time to work through it. And then you can choose, am I going to go through puberty as a male or a female? And I think that's actually a really cool way of dealing with it, giving them time. Mm-hmm. And when you're still young, maybe you can work through it and consolidate the identity that matches your body. But, you know, at 46, I think Chris was quite certain that she was identified as a female.
Yeah, and in fact, you mentioned in the book that the country in the world that does the most of these kinds of surgeries is Thailand, and they don't wait till somebody's in their 50s. If the average age here in this country is in the 50s, but there the average age is 20.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, it's all a matter of acceptance, and I think nowadays we're seeing that, you know, we're much more open about these things, and young kids are talking about it. And, you know, I also worry that if you get a really little kid, you know, let's look into it and try to figure it out and try to redirect it so that the body and the gender identity do match. Because there are issues where a parent can be driving something because of their own issues. I mean, some people have talked to me about my mom dressed me, or someone relative in my family dressed me as a female because they wanted a female, even though it was a male body. And I think if that's going on, well, let's fix it when it's a little kid. But, you know, if it's just unfolding and no good explanation and no good way to get it back on course with the body, then at least we're now open about it and dealing with it. It's just so sad how many suicides there are among transgenders.
But that's, now we have hope for Chris, because he is able to go through this. He's been accepted by his coworkers, and things are looking up for him. So we are going to leave on that note of optimism, Anne. Thank you for writing this book.
You're welcome. And it's nice to talk with you, Nancy.
My guest has been Anne Speckhard. Her new book is Warrior Princess, A U.S. Navy SEAL's Journey to Coming Out Transgender. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.